The outgoing Secretary of Labor, Tom Perez, was also a career lawyer and a career public servant. And when he came in at the Civil Rights Division, which was his first job under President Obama, he had to clean up the mess that Alex Acosta and Bradley Schlotzman and George W. Bush had made of the Civil Rights Division. There are a couple of famous moments from 2009, 2010, where Perez and Holder had to sort of go to the Civil Rights Division staff and tell them, look, you're open for business again. This is once again an agency of the federal government that's going to do its job. That's how dark and how deep the damage was from the Bush years. And now we've got another career attorney coming in to run the Department of Labor, sort of in the reverse pattern of Perez's own career arc within the Obama administration. And I think it's noteworthy that there is such a contrast between Andy Puzder, Donald Trump's original nominee, fast food CEO with a sort of brash outward demeanor and a negative reputation, and lots of Oppo research kept coming out and coming out and coming out. Puzder sort of fits the Trump brand. Alex Acosta is a much more sort of buttoned-up professional type of guy. His reputation is for highly competent management. He's got a decade, two decades of public service behind him. And if you're a progressive or a liberal or a Democrat, that's probably almost more worrying than the idea of Andy Puzder running the Department of Labor, because Acosta's record is as someone who can very competently execute the agenda of his boss inside of a complex federal bureaucracy. So if you want to find somebody who can sabotage a federal agency and turn it against its whole purpose, Alex Acosta's resume is glimmering. It's exactly who you want if you're out to sabotage the Department of Labor.
Well, Alan Pike, I want to thank you for being with us, editor with Think Progress. His latest article, Who is Alex Acosta? Trump's backup labor secretary has skeletons in his closet, too. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gattas, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Ravi Karan, Honey Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Andre Lewis, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Paul Huckabee, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:01. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
Thank you to all of our new and renewing members during our winter membership drive. That makes KBOO one of the best community radio stations in the country. Thank you once again for being the best supporters a station could ever ask for.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Winter Folk 29 on Saturday, February 18th at 7 p.m. at the Alberta Rose Theater in Portland. Winter Folk is an annual folk music concert benefiting Sisters of the Road. This is Winter Folk's 29th year. Performers include Cozy Sheridan, Tom May, Richard Colombo, and Lori Lynn, and more. Again, that's Winter Folk 29, Saturday, February 18th at 7 p.m. at the Alberta Rose Theater, 3000 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from ADX, a collaboration hub offering the access to shared wood, metal, screen printing, jewelry, and digital design shops through a monthly membership program. The ADX Makerspace Learning Center and Fabrication Shop allows people to bring their ideas to life. Open every day at 417 Southeast 11th in Portland and at adxportland.com. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, about 200 people gathered yesterday for a rally in March to celebrate the life of Quenice Hayes.
Local restaurants will donate a percentage of this week's profits to the American Civil Liberties Union.
Scott Pruitt has been confirmed as the director of Environmental Protection Agency.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 17th, 2017, the 28th day of the Trumpocalypse.
I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund. About 200 people gathered yesterday for a rally and a march to celebrate the life of Quanice Hayes. According to police, the 17-year-old was suspected of armed robbery. He was fatally shot by the Portland police officer Andrew Hurst on Thursday morning. Police later found a replica gun near his body. Portland Student Action Network, a high school activism group that organized Thursday's demonstration, called Hayes' death, quote, an unjust and devastating killing of a child at the hands of an oppressive police force, end quote. The rally started out peacefully, but tensions rose as the group began marching through downtown Portland. Portland police allege marchers threw signs and cones into the street and confronted officers on Southwest Oak Street. One protester was arrested. Zachary P. Lang was booked into the Multnomah County Jail on a riot accusation, a Class C felony. The actual circumstances of the Hayes shooting remain unclear and many questions remain unanswered. Only the police account is known at this time. Mayor Ted Wheeler has stated that he wants a, quote, speedy and transparent investigation, end quote, and that information would be shared with the public. The investigation is expected to take 4 to 6 weeks, at which point it will be turned over to the grand jury.
A growing number of Portland-area restaurants plan to donate a portion of this week's profits to the American Civil Liberties Union. The initiative, which has been dubbed Immigrants Welcome, was conceived by Andy Ricker, owner of Pock Pock. In comments to KGW-TV, Ricker said, quote, "The restaurant industry is built with immigrant labor and immigrant creativity. We wouldn't have a restaurant industry without immigrants," end quote. Ricker went on to say that the ACLU is fighting for non-criminal immigrants and he wanted to show support. At last count, over 50 restaurants had agreed to donate up to 10% of their profits to the organization. Interested diners can see the latest list on Hot Lips Pizza Facebook page. Immigrants Welcome follows Thursday's Without Immigrants protest, where a number of Portland restaurants and other businesses closed to show their support for Oregon's immigrant community.
Since 2015, four Oregon counties have enacted what they call Second Amendment preservation ordinances, and others are considering similar measures. Oregon News Service and KBOO's Demi Hellenius have the report.
A measure challenging gun regulations is popping up in Oregon counties. Since 2015, four counties have passed a measure known as Second Amendment Preservation Ordinance, and commissioners in Malheur Union and Lake counties have heard the same measure in the past few weeks. The ordinance is a reaction to the Oregon Firearms Safety Act, passed by the state legislature in 2015, which requires background checks for transfers between private parties. These county ordinances allow sheriffs to ignore this law, which advocates see as unconstitutional. However, head of Ceasefire Oregon Penny Akamoto says there's a fatal flaw in this measure.
There's an Oregon firearms preemption law that states that counties, municipalities, cities actually can't make certain laws regarding certain aspects of firearm sales, ownership, storage. So these ordinances or resolutions really are largely very symbolic.
The legality of this ordinance still is in question. Rob Taylor of Coos County is one of the chief petitioners for the Second Amendment Preservation Ordinance. He says he wants Oregon to have sanctuary counties for the Second Amendment.
The same way Oregon has become a sanctuary state for immigration.
While Akamoto and Taylor disagree over the measure, they both point to poor mental health services for Oregonians and the role that plays in preventing violence. Taylor says Governor Kate Brown's proposal to shut down a mental health hospital in Junction City could hurt the people it serves.
It doesn't matter whether they get a gun, a car, or a bomb. If they have those thoughts, they're going to act upon it. And so the best thing to do is to have places like mental hospitals so we can have people go and get those problems healed or cured.
Akamoto says one of the biggest concerns from gun violence is suicide, which accounts for most of the violent deaths from guns.
You can pass all these ordinances you want, but that's not really taking a look at the fact that a lot of people in these rural counties are using their guns to kill themselves. And that's an issue that really needs to be addressed.
For KBOO News, I'm Demi Hellenius.
An Oregon state senator has submitted a bill that would ban late-term sex-selective abortions. Senate Bill 541, sponsored by Kaiser Republican Representative Kim Thatcher, would ban abortions that were, quote, performed solely because of the known or suspected sex of an unborn child, unquote. Thatcher did not provide any data on how often these abortions are performed. Not surprisingly, the proposed bill has brought strong opposition from pro-choice groups. Planned Parenthood of Oregon is concerned that it would turn doctors into investigators and patients into suspects, and ultimately limit a woman's ability to make her own health care decisions. Seven states already have bans on sex-selective abortions. Arizona, Kansas, North Carolina, North Dakota, South Dakota, Oklahoma, and Pennsylvania.
Oregon Senator Ron Wyden is hosting a series of town halls throughout the state during the first recess of the 115th Congress. The 11 individual sessions are scheduled by county and will run from Saturday, February 18th through Saturday, February 25th. It kicks off with Clackamas County's town hall, which will be held tomorrow at 9:30 a.m. at the Oregon City High School gym. The concluding session is the Multnomah County Town Hall, which is scheduled for Saturday, February 25th. That meeting will take place at noon at the David Douglas High School, 1001 Southeast 135th Avenue in Portland. Interested citizens are urged to attend. For additional information, go to www.wyden.senate.gov/Oregon.
About 300 marchers rallied Friday in Olympia, Washington, to urge lawmakers to do more for children who are homeless or in foster care. Many were young people in their 20s who had personally experienced mistreatment in the system. Critics of foster care in the state have claimed that many foster parents are abandoning the system, complaining that the Department of Social and Health Services is understaffed. They maintain that foster youth are shuffled from home to home, making their already chaotic lives even worse. In meetings with 40 legislators and aides, the young marchers sought support for a half dozen bills and budget items related to retaining foster parents, helping foster kids get driver's license, and keeping youth out of juvenile detention. The state legislature is already hard-pressed to meet Washington's multi-billion dollar education funding demands. State law requires that those needs be funded, so it's not clear that the state will be able to do anything for foster kids who have no legal mandate.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for an intermittent showers with a high temperature of about 50. East of the Cascades and Hood River, you can expect morning showers and a partly cloudy day with temperatures in the high 40s. On this date in 1960, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was arrested in the Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott. The boycott began on the day that Rosa Parks went to court for her refusal to yield her seat to a white man on a Montgomery bus. The boycott of public buses by blacks in Montgomery lasted 381 days and ended when the city passed an ordinance authorizing black bus passengers to sit virtually anywhere they chose on the buses. Today's quote is from Rosa Parks, who said, quote, "I was not tired physically, no. The only tired I was tired of giving in," end quote.
And now here's KBOO's Ray Bodwell with a look at some of this week's fabrications from the Trump administration.
You're saying it's a falsehood, and Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts.
Despite the treasure trove of fabrications and half-truths from yesterday's presidential press conference, we're actually going to start out this week with a couple of comments from Trump's senior policy advisor and aspiring brown shirt, Stephen Miller. Miller made the rounds of Sunday morning news programs defending Mr. Trump's claim that both he and defeated U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte would have won in New Hampshire had not illegal voters been bussed in from neighboring Massachusetts.
I've actually, having worked before on a campaign in New Hampshire, I can tell you that this issue of busing voters into New Hampshire is widely known by anyone who's worked in New Hampshire politics. It's very real. It's very serious. This morning on this show is not the venue for me to lay out all the evidence, but I can tell you this. Voter fraud is a serious problem in this country.
He followed this flagrant falsehood by going completely ballistic in defense of the president.
And I'm prepared to go on any show, anywhere, anytime, and repeat it and say the president of the United States is correct 100%.
These claims have been investigated in the past, and after hearing Miller's rant, former New Hampshire Attorney General and prominent Republican Tom Rath tweeted, quote, "Let me be as unequivocal as possible. Allegations of voter fraud are baseless, without merit. It's shameful to spread these fantasies," end quote. But enough about Miller. Let's listen to the president. He started out his Thursday press conference complaining about how difficult his job is.
To be honest, I inherited a mess. It's a mess.
Certainly no one thinks the job of president of the United States is easy, but Barack Obama inherited a global financial collapse and the worst recession since the Great Depression, as well as two separate wars. That probably wasn't a walk in the park either. Mr. Trump then returned to his favorite theme, his record-breaking victory in the Electoral College.
We got 306 because people came out and voted like they've never seen before. I guess it was the biggest Electoral College win since Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan was president from 1980 to 1988. Mr. Trump's claim would be true if it weren't for the fact that George H.W. Bush in 1988, Bill Clinton in both 1992 and 1996, and Barack Obama in both 2008 and 2012 all got significantly higher electoral vote totals than Mr. Trump. But at least his poll numbers are good.
A new Rasmussen poll, in fact, because the people get it. Much of the media doesn't get it. They actually get it, but they don't write it. A new Rasmussen poll just came out just a very short while ago, and it has our approval rating at 55% and going up.
The 55% approval rating figure is indeed what the Rasmussen poll reports. But a closer look reveals that Rasmussen Reports is a conservative-leaning publication that has had its objectivity questioned in the past. 10 other polls have recently shown Mr. Trump's approval rating falling between 39% and 48%. Of course, those polls apparently don't matter to Mr. Trump, since he recently tweeted that, quote, "any negative polls are fake news," end quote. As a sidebar, I couldn't help noticing that the Rasmussen Reports are based in Asbury Park, New Jersey. Bruce Springsteen must be cringing at that news. Later in the press conference, Trump accused Hillary Clinton of selling uranium to the Russians.
We had Hillary Clinton give Russia 20% of the uranium in our country. You know what uranium is, right? It's a thing called nuclear weapons and other things, like lots of things are done with uranium, including some bad things.
This appears to be a reference to the fact that Russia's nuclear power agency bought a large interest in a Canadian company that owns mines and tracts of lands in the U.S. They have about 20% of the uranium production capacity in this country. That is not the same as 20% of the uranium in our country. The deal did happen while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, but in that role there was nothing that she could have done to prevent it. Later, after having spent a large part of the nearly 80-minute press conference berating the press corps for, quote, fake news, end quote, Mr. Trump set the press up to take the blame if he is unable to develop a relationship with Russia.
I love to negotiate things. I do it really well. But it's possible I won't be able to get along with Putin. Maybe it is. But I want to just tell you, the false reporting by the media, by you people, the false, horrible, fake reporting makes it much harder to make a deal with Russia.
One can assume that soundbite played well, after careful editing, to anyone whose primary source of information is Fox News, Breitbart, or Alex Jones. Then, after berating a young reporter for having the audacity to ask about the documented rise in anti-Semitism during the first month of the new Republican administration, Mr. Trump had this surreal bit of dialogue with April Ryan, an African-American and a reporter for American Urban Radio Network.
Are you going to include the CBC, Mr. President, in your conversations with your urban agenda, your inner city agenda, as well as...
Are you
going to include the Congressional Black Caucus and the Congressional...
Well,
Hispanic
I would.
Caucus,
I tell you what. Do you want to set up the meeting? Do you want to set up the meeting?
No.
Are they friends of yours?
Once it dawned on the president that Ms. Ryan was referring to the Congressional Black Caucus, he seemed to suggest that simply because she is black, she must be friends with the CBC. One could draw the conclusion from the exchange that Mr. Trump is either clueless or a racist. It's hard to decide for a president which is worse. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Despite strong objections from the Democrats, environmentalists, and employees of the agency, Scott Pruitt was confirmed today as the next head of the Environmental Protection Agency. The vote was 52-46. Democrats Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota voted in favor of Pruitt. Susan Collins of Maine was the lone Republican to vote against. During his confirmation hearings, Pruitt said that he disagreed with President Trump's position that global warming was a hoax, but he has previously made statements challenging the science behind climate change. In his 6 years as Oklahoma Attorney General, Pruitt filed 14 lawsuits attempting to overturn EPA regulations on emissions from coal-fired power plants. More recently, he sued the EPA over the expansion of water bodies protected under the Clean Water Act. Many agency employees expressed concern that the nominee has been selected to run an agency has made a career of fighting by a president who was repeatedly vowed to get rid of it. And in an almost unprecedented show of opposition, EPA scientists, lawyers, and policy experts had mounted a telephone campaign urging senators to vote against the nominee. Claiming that Pruitt had not been fully vetted, Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley unsuccessfully tried to have the vote postponed until after next Tuesday's release of thousands of emails containing Pruitt's correspondence with the fossil fuel industry. After the vote, he said, quote, "Today is a dark day for our country and for our planet," end quote.
In Salem, an ongoing summit that takes a critical look at the Oregon criminal justice system enters its final day. The summit was organized by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission and What Works, a community organization overseen by Multnomah County. KBOO's Karen James spoke with Michael Schmidt, executive director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, about the event. She asked Schmidt to elaborate on what justice reinvestment looks like.
This is our second criminal justice reinvestment summit that we've held in the state. The first one was in 2015. And really, it's a chance to get everybody back together across the public safety system to discuss what's happened, celebrate successes to date, but also look forward and see what kinds of things can we continue to work on and learn from each other and network with each other to just see what's working in Oregon.
And what is justice reinvestment?
Yeah, justice reinvestment is what we refer to it as, but it's really House Bill 3194. It was passed in 2013. The statute, the legislation itself, did two things. It changed some sentence lengths for certain crimes. It targeted property and drug crimes. So it reduced the sentence length for identity theft, for robbery in the third degree, for marijuana-related crimes. It reduced the sentences for certain drug crimes. But then it also created a grant program. And the grant program really is what brings us here today, because all 36 counties have been participating and receiving justice reinvestment grants for the last 4 years at this point. And we've invested almost over $50 million across the state into public safety programs. And so that really seems to be the driving force of the success that we're seeing from the program, is getting folks together in local counties to talk about their local public safety systems and make decisions about how best they can supervise people locally while protecting the public instead of sending them to prison. And the idea is that we might even get better results from that and see lower recidivism rates when we can invest in treatment and housing and the things that we know that people need to make them more likely to succeed on probation.
The money was diverted by passage of House Bill 3194 in 2013. Talk about how that money was diverted from the prisons to the counties.
Yeah, so the whole idea underpinning justice reinvestment is that you can invest locally in public safety programs, which will allow local systems to send less people to prison, to have resources to work with them in the community so that you can ensure community safety and get better results. if we do that, less people go to prison. And if there are less people going to prison, the state doesn't need to invest that money into building new prisons or expanding existing prisons and facilities. So we track very closely how much money we see that the state is avoiding having to spend on increased Department of Corrections budgets and on opening new prisons. And so the idea is that all the money that we can avoid spending on new prisons, we can then reinvest locally into the community.
And Michael Schmidt, you gave some male and female prison population forecast that avoided building a new prison. That was very exciting news. Talk about that.
Yeah, so it's funny. In preparation for this summit, I looked back at old newspaper articles, and I found a newspaper article that happened just before justice reinvestment legislation was passed that essentially said Oregon is on the path to having to open a brand new prison in Junction City by February of 2017. I couldn't believe it, because here we are in February 2017, and the graphs that I showed today demonstrate that we are not projecting needing a new prison for male offenders all the way out. We look to 2026. And we still don't cross that line. So we have moved from where we needed a new prison from 2017 to beyond 2026 at this point. We also look at the women's numbers. In Oregon, we have one prison facility that houses all of the female offenders, and that one is at capacity. But again, the newspaper article said we would need to have the second women's prison open by 2015. And here we are in 2017. We still haven't done that. We are on the cusp. It's very much under discussion of having to do that. But to date, we still have avoided having to open additional facility for women. So just, I mean, two huge successes. We have avoided building a prison and avoided opening another prison because of the work around justice reinvestment.
And who is represented today at the Criminal Justice Summit?
Yeah, incredible turnout. We had over 1,000 people register to attend. I'm told by last count, and it's just, at lunchtime now, we've had 850 people actually walk through the doors physically. But it's broad representation across our public safety system. The local public safety coordinating councils have representatives. We have state agency folks, state legislators. We have DAs and judges and criminal defense attorneys represented. We have mental health workers who are here to learn about the intersection between mental illness and the criminal justice system. So it really is pretty much some of everybody. And it's actually we were surprised at how evenly distributed each of those categories is. People have good representation across our system here.
Oregon is in a budget crisis. Do you expect any major cuts to the criminal justice system this year from our legislature?
You're absolutely right. This is a very tough budget cycle. So we are looking at the governor's recommended budget. We are a state agency. We support her budget. She had to make some very tough decisions. And in those tough decisions, that does include reduced funding for justice reinvestment. But we're extremely heartened that, I mean, this is a program that is, you know, not building a physical prison or buying cars or the things that absolutely have to happen. This is a program that she believes in and has continued to invest considerably or ask the legislature to invest in considerably, even when our state's facing a $1.7 billion shortfall. So we very much have the governor's support. It is a little bit less than it was funded in this current biennium, but just really still in this budget climate to have that kind of support is huge.
So the Justice Reinvestment Summit is February 16th and 17th. We're here in day one. What do you hope the participants will take away from this summit?
You know, we really worked hard to have something for everybody. The genius, I guess, of the justice reinvestment legislation was that counties are the drivers. Their local systems are the drivers of what it is that they invest in. And so for different counties and different jurisdictions, it's going to be different things. It's not all the same thing. And so we try to have programs here to talk about, you know, pretrial practices and reform, to look at mental illness in jails and how that's being used. I was just sitting in a presentation on veterans and trauma and how brain trauma influences people's behavior and being cognizant and working with those people. We've heard from one of our main speakers talked about women in our system and how they should be looked at as a discrete population, not just like how we treat the men and how we've done it, but looking at them specifically with separate issues. And so, you know, we're hoping everybody comes away with at least something. And I think we're going to do that. I mean, I really think it's a broad spectrum of topics to cover. It's very wide ranging, but hopefully everybody gets something.
I've been speaking with Michael Schmidt, Executive Director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission at the 2017 Justice Reinvestment Summit. For KBOO News, I'm Karen James.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tom Flynn, Demi Helinius, and Khalid Mosley. The producer is Ray Bodwell. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The KABU Evening News Director is Zelle Marchant, and the Evening Public Affairs Director is Kanan Schlesinger.
A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KABU News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. Coming up Monday morning on KABU at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, a look at the recent police shootings in Portland. At 9, social and political commentary on the Old Mole Variety Hour. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein hosts this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. At 11 on the Radio Zine, Veterans for Peace discuss the departure of Flynn from the Trump administration, then a celebration of Black History Month with a look back at Muhammad Ali and the Freedom Riders. Thank you, KABU members, for your generous support. If you're not yet a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. And now stay tuned for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. And have a great weekend.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines.